Good morning. Today is Wednesday, November the 17th. Joining us this morning is Humboldt County Supervisor, Mr. Mike Wilson. Good morning.
Good morning to you, Brian.
Boy, you're sounding like you're next door to us. That's great.
There you go.
Right. Kind of frightening.
Strong signal.
Going to keep looking over my shoulder now. All right. Are you ready?
Right here behind you, Brian.
Yeah. I kind of have got, and I don't know if this is going to be an easy one for you or not, but it's a water-related question for this morning.
Well, I've gotten every single one of them wrong,
well,
so my record is pretty, it's at least consistent.
Pristine, yes. Okay, here we go. Why do oysters make pearls?
How do they make pearls?
No, why?
Why does an oyster make a pearl? Well, and I would assume it's like a basically like a cyst around a piece of sand or something that gets stuck inside there, and they got to smooth it out so it doesn't cause some kind of infection for the animal. That's my guess.
Well, I think that this might go down as your first victory. The type of oysters that make pearls spend most of their time on the sandy bottoms of tropical seas. When a grain of sand or other foreign particle get inside the oyster's shell and become an irritant, the oyster system automatically begins coating the particle with protective layer of nacre, N-A-C-R-E, mother of pearl. Okay, that would make sense that it was mother of pearl. Okay. As layer after layer is added, the pearl is formed.
Amazing.
Way to go.
Boy. Well, pearls are another carbon sequestration device. There you go.
A what?
Carbon sequestration. You know, we're you know, in our battle to combat climate change, it's all about carbon, right? It's all about we produce too much carbon into the atmosphere, so we're always looking for places to store carbon or to sequester it.
Oh, okay.
Like sequester. So trees, and then shellfish, you know, like in Humboldt Bay, shellfish sequester carbon, so they are actually, for every gram of protein that we derive from that meat source, there is a certain amount of carbon that's sequestered, whereas most of our other protein sources, at least from meat, produce carbon into the atmosphere. So
when I eat a crab,
they have a carbon footprint.
So when we have crab in a couple of weeks, mm-hmm. is that a shellfish or is that another fish?
Well, it's a crustacean, but I would say it probably has a pretty high ratio of carbon sequestration because that's all that shell.
Right.
So
right.
You just think about like the ratio between what it's producing in terms of bone or shell relative to the amount of meat, right? And where like a cow has a lot of meat and then relatively little bone that's
gotcha.
Created.
Okay.
So, right, and cows also do that thing with the methane as well and some other things. So they tend to be fairly high producers in terms of carbon footprint.
So you're,
relative
you're saying that
to these other things.
Eat more seafood.
You can. I mean, you know, it's all about everything's in moderation. I think I'm not saying don't eat a cow. It's just that we, you know, need to be conscious of all our impacts. And that's one of them. So anyways, oysters are cool. We like oysters, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
85% of California's oysters in Humboldt Bay, so they not only, you know, carbon sequestering, but they also clean the water too.
Double victories.
Yeah. Great. Good for the environment.
Hey, speaking of seafood and Humboldt Bay, what are you hearing about the Nordic Farms? I've heard a couple of things that there's some nice progress going on, some of the preliminary stuff. I've heard that there are some folks that are driving stakes that they don't want them or anybody. And, you know, that the full range, full gamut. What are you hearing? Because you obviously you're tapped into different sources than what I am. What are you hearing about the progress and just the, I guess the project overall?
Well, I don't follow it super closely in that it's part of the decision-making process that'll come to us. And so I follow it from a distance a little bit because these projects change so much. I can't devote a ton of energy as they're changing through their process and then devote a lot of energy at the end. But what I do know is that the county working with Nordic is getting close to producing their environmental impact report, which is, you know, a very, very robust study of all of the potential impacts. And I think that was done. There was a request from community members that that the project receive that level of a review, and the project proponents, Nordic, responded positively to that request, and so that's what they're doing. And I don't think the report is out yet. I'm sure it's not out. So when it does come out, people will have a chance to review that document and see for themselves what the planners and the scientists say about the potential impacts of that project. And
an EIR isn't something that is routinely done. It's just done for exceptional projects.
Yeah, it's only done when a project meets what's called a level of significance and an unmitigated level of significance. And so, like, what it means by unmitigated means that you just can't, like, change the project and then make it so that the impacts, whatever they may be, whether it's to traffic or to air or to water quality or visual impacts or whatever they may be, there's just a whole, you know, litany of things we review through the Environmental Quality Act, which is a California law. If you can mitigate or make those to less than significant levels, then generally you get what's called a negative declaration, which is a review which is not as stringent as an environmental impact report. Sometimes you can make all those things, and even if a project's controversial, that can be the threshold to move to an environmental impact report for, you know, more stringent and in-depth review. And sometimes project proponents just do it anyway because they want to avoid more controversy, but also makes the project stronger from a legal perspective.
Okay. So EIRs are then done for commercial projects, or?
They can be done for anything. An environmental impact report can be done for any project, whether it's commercial or nonprofit. There's restoration projects that have environmental impact reports sometimes because they're impacting maybe other resources. So,
or traffic patterns kind of thing?
A housing project, a hospital, a Nordic Aqua Farms, a wind project. It can be, and oftentimes the threshold can be a bit based on a community standard of what one community thinks is impactful over another. So a community, say, in Los Angeles or might be different than Modesto, might be different than Arcata,
sure,
about what that is. But that's where they're at, I think. And, you know, I think some of the issues that I'm hearing about tend to be around water use, either the freshwater use and the saltwater use, and then the water impacts associated with, because there's going to be wastewater that comes from that, and how is it treated, and how treated is it, and what impacts it
all
might
that
have.
Stuff,
those are
kind
of those are the big ones.
It's 8:19.
Join Warren Eckstein on KINS in the 6 o'clock hour as he explains pet behaviors, different fun facts, tips, and all sorts of info about your animals and the way they think and act.
Here are just some of the things that kids learn when they have pets in their life.
If you're an animal lover, this is absolutely the program you need to hear.
You know, vocalizations are a very important part of animal communication and their language. Hi, this is Warren Eckstein. Hear my daily pet tip weekdays on KINS FM.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:19. No, it's not. It's 8:24. We're back talking shop this morning with Mr. Wilson, who...
You've zoomed ahead here.
Yeah. Well, you know, me and my notes, we get lost sometimes. Mike, before the break, you had said something about different projects, different situations, different applications can cause a trigger for an EIR. And I know that in that arena is where you cut your teeth in your career, your pre-political career. But for a lot of us, you know, is that like the traffic study? So if you put in a restaurant, let's say, or a new restaurant in an area, what are the ripples of that going on? Is that kind of the basics?
Right. I mean, if you're putting in a new restaurant somewhere, if there's already a restaurant in that location, right, the impacts are probably going to be a lot less because
right.
It's like what is the existing conditions? And so that's really what the change is. We're looking at what the existing conditions are and then what that change might be. And so a restaurant that might require a stoplight or something like that, again, on a project of that scale, typically you would list out what we call those mitigations, what those ways we're going to address those particular impacts. So you would have a traffic study for sure. It might not be as in-depth as, you know, if it was a bigger project, and then that traffic study identifies something that you need to do to deal with that issue, whether it's traffic or it can be noise and it could be even air quality, say there's vents from the fryers or whatever
it can be.
And then you make the changes to the project that address those issues, and then you basically either just get a permit or have a negative declaration and move forward with the permit.
So with
if there's something unmitigatable, like if your restaurant was built like on a wetland, right, and there's just no way that you can, you know, address that problem, whatever that is, that environmental problem, then you would have to go to what's called an EIR to make a finding that there was some reason that the restaurant is so important that it has some societal benefit that's so immense that it's worth the impacts.
So like Alazio's, if it was still in effect or still in location there and somebody wanted to work with it, would that, because it was pre-existing, they wouldn't need an EIR, but if somebody was looking to put a restaurant there at that location today, they would then need an EIR?
Well, pre-existing means it exists at the time you start your process.
Right,
so,
right. No,
Lazio's is not pre-existing. So.
Right. Well, let's go back. Okay, if somebody had continued and that business was continuing to operate and they were going to be doing some adjustments to it, that wouldn't require an EIR. But today, if Wilson and Papstein decide we want to put in Lazio's 2 or whatever it would be called, then it would go through all the EIR, even though historically that had been a restaurant location.
I couldn't imagine an odder couple to open a business together.
Yes, I concur. Yeah, we'd have a very interesting menu choices. How's that?
Yeah.
Now, what about all these ADUs that so many jurisdictions are pushing in, the mother-in-law units, the freestanding buildings in the back of the property, that kind of stuff? If you have one of those in the neighborhood, yeah, okay, fine, no big deal. But if everybody's putting in one of those into a residential neighborhood, the cumulative effect of that is going to change certain things, but each individual wouldn't. So how does something like that come into play?
That might, and I believe, I don't know, I don't think we're doing an ADU ordinance at the county. I think we already did. I was trying to think about, they get adjusted every once in a while. But in general, you do an environmental review associated with that. And, yeah, if you can come up with policies that address the issues that you're talking about, that, you know, aggregated or accumulative, those impacts, then you would have a negative declaration and move forward. But sometimes you're right, like that there can be a lot of impacts associated with that were not accounted for, and that is a perfect example of where you might balance some of those impacts and accepting some of those impacts or you might need more analysis and you would do an environmental impact report. So that's definitely one of those places. And we, you know, ADUs is one way to address housing for us, and as you know, it's even when we talk about projects like Nordic or the wind farm or whatever it is, we have more workforce than we have housing, and certainly that's one of the ways that we would deal with that.
Right, but I'm thinking, okay, now let's say instead of business partners, we're neighbors, which again might also be a stretch, but well, let's go with it.
Come on, move to Arcata.
So, well, yeah. So you guys added a mother-in-law unit, and then we do as individual projects, and then in 6 months somebody else does, and a year and a half later somebody else does, and now we've got 4 of these in our cul-de-sac. Okay. The last guy shouldn't bear the burden of having to do one of these reports. So is it it's happening?
That's why we do these ordinances up front, and we do the analysis of, you know, the full build out ahead of time. Yeah, absolutely. Because then that's why then these things get principally permitted or conditionally permitted, and there are ways to deal with that. And typically things like in the more mundane yet controversial parts of this is parking. Like, what's the parking going to be in the neighborhood? Because,
right,
of course, we seem to be more concerned about where cars live than where people live sometimes, quite often. And so that tends to be one of the issues that gets, you know, analyzed up front, and then whether or not we worry about that. And then what is the threshold for what is significant parking problem or not a problem? So, that is definitely, that changes from community to community. What do you think is a parking problem? Like, do I have to walk a block? Do I have to walk 10 feet? Do I, you know,
right,
what's
right,
the difference?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. KINS, news and information time. I know it is, 8:30.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
And these kids who come, they become Americans before a lot of Americans become Americans.
Now, here's your host, Lars Larson.
Hey there, it's Lars Larson. Join me for the Lars Larson Show, weeknights 10 to midnight. Honestly provocative talk radio on KINS.
Good morning, KINS, news and information time. It's 8:35. We're back talking shop with the proprietors of Wilson Papstein Restaurant, Inc. I don't know
what the Yelp reviews on that are going to be.
Yeah, but, well, Yelp might become a verb then rather than a noun.
Exactly.
Yes. Mr. Wilson is alongside this morning. Mike, with some of the different challenges that are out there, there are still lots of positives. You know, you mentioned the Nordic Farms, and that there was some concerns about water, I guess, going into the project and coming out of the project. And, you know, for those of us that have been around for a while, there was a whole lot more water being taken for the pulp mills when they were there. The fact that they're not there and that this would be taking a percentage of that, but not all of that, does that have the opportunity or the trigger to go back
question, because the pulp mills themselves consumed somewhere around, I think, 60 million gallons a day when it was fully going of river water from the Mad River.
Yes.
And that water, you know, was really, quite frankly, paying for a lot of the municipal systems as that industrial use. And that water didn't just come from the river, you know, just directly out of the river without management. We have the dam, the Matthews Dam, which is Ruth Lake, which basically is our storage for that water. And Matthews Dam and Ruth Lake fills up within the first, it's already full this year, right?
Right.
We had a drought, right? And in the first big storm, full. And so we're really fortunate in that way. And the Mad River itself is a pipeline, right? So the water is let out from that dam and down through to both the municipal and industrial services. And so that water has been let out less because the demand has dropped dramatically without those industrial users. So it's an interesting tie between water in the river and excluding sort of the tributaries and those other little parts that go offwards, which are really important to the ecosystem. But within the river itself, you know, water is flowing through that. The Nordic Aqua Farms is proposing, I think, to use about 2 million gallons a day, which is significantly less, you know, an order of magnitude less, more than 10 times less than the pulp mills. So it is an interesting thing, and we have been talking about water rights in terms of Humboldt County's sort of claim to water and use it or lose it clauses in the state's water planning process. And we've talked about that a bit before, too. So so there's that. And then there's also the amount of water that the Nordic is proposing to use from the bay. And so that's also in there, and they have to look at ways to not, you know, suck in all these other, you know, biota and plants and animals that are functional to the bay. They have to do that. The other part of this, too, is energy. So the Nordic Aquaform is going to use a lot of energy. But what's interesting about that is it's comparable to a pulp mill. So where we lost energy draw when we lost the two pulp mills, the Nordic Aquaform is not more than what was being drawn when the pulp mill was in that location. So while it is a lot relative to, say, I mean, it's, I think it's the equivalent of like the city of Arcata or something, you know, it's a pretty sizable amount of energy. It is, you know, it's an industrial process. It's still less than what the industrial use was there.
Right, the infrastructure
15
can,
years ago.
The infrastructure can handle it, yeah.
Well, I mean, again, most of our energy is drawn from a local power plant, so the capacity exists. And certainly if offshore wind happens, then that local power draw will be clean energy, wind energy, so that would be part of the deal. But the way that they're calculating sort of their, and we talked about carbon footprint at the beginning, which was that they're producing a product fish, or they would be producing a product that's a fresh fish that typically would be flown into the West Coast from, say, Norway or from Chile or from Canada. And so the offset, even though there's some energy use in the production, you're not flying the meat around, that it's produced close enough to be trucked around so that the energy use is quite a bit less and the price, and that competes with flown in fish.
Well,
so that's their model.
Does the employment base factor into this at all, or is this all outside of the economics of it?
Employment is a big deal everywhere, and I'm sure it will be for this. And again, as always, our biggest challenge in employment is not just finding people, but really finding places for workforce to
sure.
live.
Sure, yeah, the whole thing around employees, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, it's not just about building units. We also need to concentrate on policies to protect units. So short-term rentals, which is like vacation rentals, Airbnbs, have probably pulled out close to 1,000 units in our area in Humboldt County. And that's hard to replace those, and it puts a lot of pressure on the housing market, and especially for rentals. And so there are a lot of communities looking at policies on how to, you know, help mitigate for that, help control that a bit.
Right, Trinidad they put one in place, didn't they, or are they still kicking that around?
They did, but they'd already lost, like, I don't know, close to 30% of their residential units, or something like that. It's a pretty significant amount, and has really made it difficult to find, you know, volunteers for the fire department and the school boards and city council. And it's just, it's hard to sustain communities without community members.
Yeah. Well, that's true with a lot of vacation areas. I've heard Napa is in the same boat where their general sales tax isn't there because they don't have the people there all the time, and they can't get people in the schools because from San Francisco moving in.
Maybe we need to think about, you know, hotel development in places where people want to be. And, you know, all these hotels that are kind of going out of service are all along the highway, where people used to think that you wanted to have your hotels. But now people really want to be someplace nice, and highways generally are not that place.
Yeah.
And so so we really should be thinking about where we might want to sort of aggregate or concentrate visitors and really start promoting some good development in that realm, so that it lessens pressure on our housing stock.
Does the general plan housing element factor into all this stuff? Because I my understanding was that that's kind of where a lot of this stuff had been worked with, and if there needed to be updates, there were updates on the housing element. Am I mistaken in that?
From my perspective, and I was a minority vote on this particular issue for the Board of Supervisors, so I won't speak for the board itself, but I found that we really didn't have a good focus. It was sort of like, let anything and everything happen, but the problem is that That doesn't actually build you more housing. Typically, you need to really focus and promote housing where it's, you know, where it's more most useful. In this case, housing close to where people work, right? That's where it is most functional, and housing that's, you know, buildable. We have, as you mentioned, a labor force problem, and if we're building, you know, 5,000 square foot second homes, you know, out in the hills or on the coast or whatever, we will still lack workforce to actually build, you know, the 40 and unit low spots or the even the duplexes and the quadplexes in our multifamily zones.
Well, so, I guess that's good then that Humboldt's got their project going with their concentrated housing
There's been a lot of success
stuff
in
going
our
on.
Housing for sure. I mean,
good stuff.
But
good
it's
stuff.
Mostly in the cities. Yeah.
True. KINS News and Information Time. It's 8:43.
Hey folks, flying local is buying local. And with three airlines serving five destinations, Humboldt County has more choices than ever. Fly on American, Avelo, or United Airlines. We have service to Denver, Hollywood Burbank, LAX, Phoenix, and San Francisco airports. Now's the time to book and save on that getaway. Or have friends and family fly to visit the beautiful Redwood Coast. For more information, go to flyhumboldt.org. Fly Humboldt, more flights to more destinations.
Good morning, KINS News and Information Time. It's 8:48. We're back talking shop this morning with Mike Wilson. Mike, when we think of Humboldt Bay, you'd mentioned earlier some of the good stuff that we've got coming out of it. Crab season certainly is coming up. I ran into somebody this weekend that was pulling crabs out at out on the beach and you know, normal, regular stuff. Are there any unique things or things that we haven't thought of that could be part of the aquaculture in Humboldt Bay?
Well, there is some very interesting new work that's coming out of Humboldt Bay, and it's around algae, seaweeds, right? Macroalgae, and even microalgae as well. So by microalgae, you mean like, you know, algae that are either single cell or filamentous, meaning they kind of like you see in the rivers where it's sort of like globs of stuff. Or just turns the water green, and
you
then macroalgae is big algae, so that's like seaweed and kelp, right? Kelp is an algae; it grows a foot a day in length. It's really quite robust. But so the Humboldt Bay Harbor District. When I was on there, when we did the pre-permitting work that was there for oysters and for aquaculture associated with shellfish, we added seaweed and algae to that pre-permitting, and now there's actually some folks coming to town, and HSU, Humboldt State University, which will be Polytech pretty soon, it looks like, are looking at various ways to grow algae for food, and I mean talking about seaweed, so like which is a popular food source for many people around the world, including locally. So for food, and then also there's medicine. There's you know, places that use different algae for different things, and even agar, that's that's in your ice cream, comes from algae from a seaweed, and then also microalgae from places like Hog Island has their hatchery, their shellfish hatchery, and they've been experimenting with algae production for food for shellfish. So like abalone and other shellfish require these algae. And so, yeah, there's just a ton of work happening. And some of your listeners might know about the collapse of the kelp off our California coast, and there's a lot of work looking at doing restoration work around that kelp and growing that kelp in Humboldt Bay. So
would this be a complement to the farm, the Nordic farm that we were talking about, to the oysters, to the shrimp, to those industries by having this product available?
Absolutely. I mean, all these systems are complementary in that they use a lot of the same networks, human networks, intelligence, and what I mean by that is just like people knowing how these systems function. They have common marketplaces. They have common footprints. Like you can grow shellfish and algae in the same location, right? And so there's just a lot of complementary aspects to growing algae and seaweeds amongst shellfish farming. And so, and even onshore where we're doing the nursery stock, as I mentioned, growing some of those algae, the microalgae, for different products as well, skincare products and other things. So there's a lot of work going into this. And like I said, Humboldt State is hot on it currently as well. And it's going to be interesting. You definitely hit my nerd button for sure on this.
That's all right.
I mean, and the people doing it are you know, an interesting combination of farmer, scientist, entrepreneur, right? Just a really fascinating group of people.
And they're all Humboldters, and that's even more impressive, working
yes,
all together.
And they love Humboldt, and they love what we got here. And so, yeah, go,
good deal.
Go Humboldt.
All righty, bud. Thanks for coming by. Appreciate the time.
Thanks for having me. Always a good time. And thanks for the easy question. I finally got
yeah, it. Yeah. Well, you realize there's a scale, and it's going to be balanced out next month.
Okay, man.
All righty. Thanks, bud.
Talk to you later. Bye,
Brian. Bye-bye.